The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tobias Matei. I'm the deputy editor of the North American Spine Society Journal, and I have the pleasure of having with me today Dr. Joe Kodama. He's a postdoc fellow at the Department of Orthopedics at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. And he wrote an article which has been published in NASJ entitled Nutrient Metabolism of the Nucleus Pulposus, a Literature Review. This is part of a special edition on advances in spinal regenerative therapies. And thank you very much for your presence today, Joe.
Thank you for having me here today.
Perfect. So I would like to go through your some of the details of your article. I know that understanding the metabolism of the disc is very important for us to be able to devise effective therapy, especially when dealing with pathologies such as degenerative disc disease, which we know affects a significant proportion of the population. It's part of the aging process, but we know that it's also significantly implicated in the development of chronic axial back pain. And so far, unfortunately, we're still lacking proven therapies that can prevent disc degeneration or that can reverse the cascade of regeneration. And part of the problem is that we're still very incipient in terms of our understanding of the pathophysiology, and especially how the nutrition of the disc space, of the intervertebral disc occurs. So that's why your article, which is very comprehensive in nature, is very timely. So I'd like to first give you an opportunity to just sketch the general, give us a general overview of your article and the topics that you address in it.
Okay. Okay, my pleasure. It's going to be a little bit longer, long. Okay, so at the beginning, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Joe Kodama. I have been practicing as a spine surgeon for almost 10 years in Japan until I came to US in 2021. Now I'm doing a postdoc scholar at the University of Maryland Orthopedic Department, Oturu's lab. So regarding my article here, you know, the energy metabolism is quite a hot topic right now, especially in the field of cancer research. Since those cancer cells, they have very unique metabolic features, researchers can target specific enzymes to restrain the proliferation or survival of cancer cells. Recently, more and more attention is being paid to how the metabolism works in our skeleton, including chondrocytes, osteoblasts, and also in disc cells. Our lab, we are particularly interested in the growth plate, which is the cartilaginous tissue in the long bone, which contribute to the bone growth. And particularly, we are looking at the energy metabolism of this organ because it takes a lot of energy to grow as much as it goes. Since I used to be a spine surgeon, I would love to learn more about how the metabolism works in spine or in disc cells more specifically. But the metabolism in disc cells have been researched in the last century, majorly by Urban's group. I don't know whether you are familiar with or not. So they are in UK. They studied a lot about the glucose metabolism in disc cells. But there are three major nutrients in cells, in human body, in cells, glucose, lipids, and amino acids. So disc cells, they have a very unique environment. The disc is the largest vascular organ in the body. So which means it doesn't have enough access to the blood circulation, and they are highly hypoxic. All of this make them highly relying on glucose metabolism. Glycolysis, which can produce energy without using oxygen. And also glucose is a very small molecule. so it can easily pass through the matrix. So without vessels, they can diffuse into the disk center and become the nutrient source. But it's interesting to think about it. Cells are made by lipids, right? Cell membrane is composed by lipids. There are a lot of molecules made by lipids, such as hormones. And even those small organelles in the cells, they have a large amount of lipids in the membrane. So
let's address a little bit the glucose. And I just want to put in perspective in terms of the clinical applications, because I would like to go systematically in these three great areas: the glucose metabolism, the amino acids, and the lipids. And one thing that I noticed when I started doing some clinical research in terms of the effects of osteoporosis upon degenerative disc disease, I remember from my fellowship that I used to see patients with severe osteoporosis in very healthy discs. And that was pretty surprising to me, because I would expect that the patient has osteoporosis, is already a disease affecting the spine. And in some way, I would expect degenerative disc disease to go along with that. And then I found several articles that support basically two pathways on how osteoporosis may actually prevent degenerative disc disease. There was a mechanical pathway that there was less stress from the end plates upon the disc itself. But one that surprised me, and I think it ties to the discussion about the metabolism of glucose, is that because there's less calcification, or the amount of calcium in the end plates is less than in a normal disc, the diffusion of glucose is facilitated. And that's why you see those large and healthy discs. And that's the opposite of what happens in advanced degenerative disc disease, where you have those calcifications of the cartilaginous end plate and those vascular buds, which seems to be termination of the capillaries that goes through the end plates, ended up being occluded. And another other factor, a very important factor that also leads to occlusion of those vascular buds is a nicotine. So we all know that nicotine plays a very significant role in terms of predisposing to degenerative disc disease. Yep. So I would just highlight that in terms of the glucose metabolism, it seems to be to me one of the central targets that we can improve the health of the disc space, or at least try to devise measures in terms of how therapies that can delay that degeneration. I don't know if that's your impression in terms of how we can act upon the disease, but I have the feeling that research on the glucose metabolism is the one that may yield the best outcomes in terms of preventing degenerative disc disease. But yeah, please let me know your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, you're exactly making the point. Yeah, understanding the glucose metabolism in, you know, the discs are composed by different types of cells, right? You're talking about the end plate cells, and the altered glucose metabolism might affect their osteogenic capacity. But in other cells, for example, the glucose metabolism, the tricky part is when the patient has altered glucose metabolism, they tend to have osteoporosis. However, many of them develop ligament ossification, right? So in different cells, in different tissues, the same energy metabolism can lead to different pathologies. So in terms of research on energy metabolism in this integrity of organs, we have to understand, for example, in disc cells, what kind of energy metabolism is best for them, and in the end plate, what kind of energy metabolism is the best. We have to decipher the specific metabolic pathways in each type of cells. Right now, I'm specifically interested in disc cells, so the nucleus corpus cells, and I want to do researches on that. But of course, as you said, we have to investigate the altered metabolism in the end plate, and also in the surrounding, for example, the AF, the annulus fibrosis, and those ligaments attaching to the spine. So this is a whole organ we have to consider separately with all of these organs. That's my opinion.
I like the idea of understanding the complex of the intervertebral disc space with the cartilaginous end plate and the separate parts, the different tissues, the ligaments, the annulus fibrosis, the nucleus pulposus, as an organ responsible for absorbing the shocks of the spine. So I like your idea of understanding the whole system and the different cells that compose it. Give me a little bit of idea of what you found in terms of the metabolism of amino acids and the production of of proteins in the disc space and how it can be altered in pathological states.
Yeah, sure. So at the beginning of this review article, I wanted to know whether other types of nutrients are used in the disc cells, because it has long been believed that glucose is the major or the only nutrient in the disc cells. But recently, so that notion was also believed in other types of bone cells, because the bone is a hypoxic environment. So even in the osteoblast, in chondrocytes, it is believed that they mainly use glucose. But recent studies reveal that those cells can also use amino acids. They also use lipids, especially in osteoblasts. So I think all of these nutrients are essential even in the disc cells. So I used a deposit data set, a single cell RNA-seq deposit, public available data set to see whether the key enzymes in these metabolic pathways are expressed in disc cells. And very interestingly, I found a lot of enzymes involved in amino acid metabolism and lipid metabolism are expressed in disc cells. Then I did a lot of literature research to see whether there are already studies about this amino acid and lipid metabolism in disc cells, but unfortunately I couldn't find any. So in this review, I know it is not normal to ask a lot of questions in the review article, but I asked a lot of questions. So I want, including me, I want future researchers can put more focus on the lipid and amino acid metabolism on the disc. Yeah.
Okay. What about the pathways involving the metabolism of lipids? Because I understand that that's a very important function in terms of maintaining the bilipid layer of the cells. So what did you find in terms of that, specifically regarding the nucleus pulposus environment?
A very interesting finding was the MP cells, they are expressing lipid receptors, lipoprotein receptors, including LDL receptor, which is the receptor for low density lipoprotein. If they don't use those lipids, it is not necessary for them to express those receptors. So I think one of my future plans is to knock out those receptors in the disc cells to see what kind of phenotype they will reveal. Yeah.
So one of the things that I would like to ask you, and I know probably the answer is not a very simplistic one way or the other in terms of building up cells or maintaining the integrity of the cells, but I can give you an example. And as a spine surgeon, you probably found the same thing. I mean, we're very familiar with the vacuum phenomenon, that you see the air in the disc space, and according to the literature, that's mainly nitrogen. But I had a few cases that I had to do a fusion on those patients with an interbody device. Yep. And the annulus fibrosis was still there. But once I opened the annulus fibrosis, there was nothing inside. I mean, the nucleus pulposus was completely gone. So my whole work in terms of preparing the removing the disc, basically the discectomy was already done, and I only had to prepare a little bit the end plates in terms of removing the cartilaginous end plate, and I was ready to insert the graft. So my question to you would be, I mean, is there a problem in terms of the cells maintaining their renewal, their auto-renewal and repopulation of the disc space? Or are the cells in the disc space more like very low metabolism cell that tend to stay there throughout decades? And once those cells ended up going through a pathway of apoptosis, you simply lose those cells. So the question is the disc space an environment which suffers or which is amenable to regeneration by the multiplication of the cells inside? Or are we set up from our early days of our life with an environment which, once impacted by deleterious factors, it's only a matter of seeing how long it can last until those cells enter into a cycle of degeneration and apoptosis?
Okay, yeah, I have seen a lot of vacuum. So it is one of the signs of the disc degeneration, right? Yes, I think it was really interesting to think about the phenomenon that, so during, for example, after disc herniation, right? Basically it's a disc injury. Like other injuries in the body, so the disc will develop angiogenesis, and also the infiltration of inflammatory cells. So in other tissues, what happens after that is the restorage of the morphology, the functionality of the tissue. However, in the disc cells, the initial repairment will undergo perfectly, but after that, the angiogenesis and the inflammatory cells infiltration will accelerate the disc degeneration, which is totally different than other tissues. My opinion here is I think those disc cells are programmed to very specific, very unique metabolic preference. They are programmed to survive in a very harsh environment, low oxygen, low nutrient. But once they are exposed to those high concentration of nutrients or oxygen, they will be overwhelmed. So one of the, maybe I'm not sure I'm answering your question or not, but one of the translational potential for metabolic studies is we can reprogram those disc cells after herniation or kind of degeneration. So even the new vessels and the inflammatory cells goes in, we can let those disc cells stay there, not go undergo apoptosis. Then we will like halt the degeneration process, or we can reverse.
Yeah. Is it your impression that because the intervertebral disc is mainly avascular, and especially the nucleus pulposus, that the main factor that may either prevent further degeneration or even lead to some improvement of the health of the disc space would be vascular factors? So in other words, is it true that probably the most promising therapies in the future in terms of preserving the disc or regenerating the disc are those target, for example, to impact the vascularization of the end plates, or maybe molecules like VEGF or other factors that impact the vascularization? Is that a good assessment of the status of research in the area?
Yeah, I think so. I agree. But however, like I said before, it's interesting to divide different departments in the disc organ. If you induce vessel ingrowth in the disc, it's tricky. Maybe it will cause, it will accelerate disc degeneration. But if you increase the vessels in the end plate, which is the transition portion between vasculature and the avascular disc, then it will exert some benefits to the disc cells by providing more nutrients. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's reasonable to investigate those possibilities.
Perfect. Yeah. So based on your understanding about the metabolism of the disc space, what do you think are the main failures of all the previous attempts to intervene into the process of degenerative disc disease? And I can cite a few of them. I mean, yep. You have, for example, platelet-rich plasma injections, or even some studies attempting to inject some sort of pluripotent cells or stem cells into the disc space. And we have all seen that even though a few articles have shown some imaging improvement, the long-term outcome of all those therapies have not been what expected, right? So what do you think are the main failures in terms of not properly understanding the metabolism of the disc space and how those apparently promising therapies ended up failing us?
Yeah, it's a really great question. Yeah. So I actually in my graduate study, I participated in some research to implant stem cells like MSCs or iPSC derived stem cells, derived chondrocytes into the disc. But a major issue is the survival of these cells. Apparently the disc, there is low oxygen, low nutrient. It's a very harsh environment for cell survival. One approach could be we prime those cells before implantation to something near to adapt their metabolic pathways to survive in a harsh environment. For example, we can suppress their metabolic activity or something like that. So we can let them survive longer in the disc environment. Actually, when we implanted chondrocyte like iPS cell derived chondrocytes. So chondrocytes, they have very similar features with disc cells. They can survive in hypoxic environment. When we implanted those chondrocytes into disc cells, they actually survived. So that can be a promising approach for future regenerative medicine, I think.
Do you see one of the problems in terms of all those therapies is the method of delivery of the cells? Because we know that one of the most basic and widely used methods to induce disc degeneration is to use a puncture, is to puncture the disc with a needle. Yeah. So that's exactly what we would be doing if we stick a needle and then we inject cells. And the same way that it's a problem, for example, for any protocol for injecting either stem cells or any type of product for spinal cord injury, we have that in the disc space. I mean, you're basically sticking a needle into the disc space, you're injecting under pressure, and that those cells will probably cause a significant disruption of the whole environment of the disc. And so it's not something that is a smooth delivery. And that's why when I was a med student, I was really interested in the protocol they had in the orthopedic department that they were studying delivering some types of mesenchymal stem cells for spinal cord injury, but they were doing that through angiography. So they were cannulating those segmental vessels and delivering those cells, and then later studying if they were actively surviving at the site of the spinal cord injury. So I think one of the problems, and I would like to hear your thoughts on that, would be even if we have an effective therapy on how to deliver either new specific medications or drugs or even those prime cells, as you mentioned, what is the most effective way to deliver that to the disc space so we don't disrupt the natural morphology and create an injury just by our intervention, right?
Yes. So one thing I have to think about is the size of the needle, right? So for mice, 30 gauge needle will be like really destructive to the AF tissue and will cause degeneration. But for human, 30 gauge needle is like neglectable for the disc mostly. But as you said, so the injection of the material by needle, I think it's not the best approach, but it's impossible to deliver those materials to the disc cells by vessels or by, because they are vascular. So we have to find way, for example, in a surgery of herniation, after we take out the herniation or take the disc, we can use the hole to deliver our materials. Or what I'm thinking, this is not practical at all, I think, but what I'm thinking is right now we're doing spinal fusion surgeries, right? Which is really pretty primitive, I think. So what if we can use some materials? We use PPS system to fix the two segment, to the fixed segment, but we don't replace the disc. We only replace the disc with bone. We use some other materials to regenerate the disc. So during that surgery, we can expose the posterior component of the disc and deliver whatever we want, right? In healthy disc, first of all, it's not necessary for us to deliver something to healthy disc, but in already degenerated disc, we can use those disruption of the AF to deliver the materials we want.
Yeah. And one of the problems that I see, and I appreciate your thoughts in terms of how to access the environment of the disc space in order to try to prevent degeneration. But one of the problems that I see is the fact that any type of systemic therapy for this type of pathologies, it's unlikely to succeed, right? One thing is to use, for example, something that may affect vascular pathways. For a patient who has cancer and we have all those anti-VEGF drugs. But here we're talking about a very widespread disease. I mean, it's patients with degenerative disc disease. I mean, we have to select within that population those patients that have back pain. Back pain itself is multifactorial. So it's even questionable if we can do more good than harm by, for example, giving someone a drug or taking any type of systemic therapy for a problem that the long-term outcome would be possibly to have an MRI that demonstrates some improvement in the health of the disc space, and how that would translate in terms of back pain is even questionable. So that's why I think when patients ask me how far we are from actively intervening prophylactically in terms of preventing disc degeneration, I think we're decades far from any clinically applicable therapy in that sense. I think any intervention that we do has to be very focal, and then we're struggling with the fact that we're only intervening those patients who already have a problem in terms of performing a microdiscectomy, but we're still missing the whole population of the large group of patients for whom they have one black disc L5-S1 and no facet degeneration and back pain. So we know that probably that pain is discogenic in nature, and still we're kind of searching for options that are less invasive than a surgical procedure, either with a fusion, which would be mainly indicated if the patient has either instability or advanced modic changes, or an arthroplasty. But it's still a big problem, advanced degenerative disc disease in the setting of back pain. And we know some patients may have other sources of back pain, but we also have extensively seen in our clinic that for some patients, the only factor affecting the health of their spine is the degenerated disc. So I appreciate and I encourage our readers to check this article and read this narrative review. It's a very extensive narrative review on all on in terms of the knowledge of the metabolism of the disk space, and it systematically goes through the metabolism of glucose, amino acid, lipids, and all. And it also it provides some it has some very interesting figures. And in at every point, I appreciate the fact that you try to tie that to the clinical setting and explore some of the studies showing, at least in the experimental setting, how all these pathways have been explored in terms of target therapies. So it's a great review. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much
for the work. And I would encourage you with the great work you've been doing in terms of your research. Anything else you would like to highlight in terms of your article or in this topic for our readers?
Yeah. Yes. In terms of prophylactic approach, I think metabolic research is very good for that because so there are two aspects. For example, aging to disc degeneration. We can investigate the metabolic change in the disc during aging. And also the another aspect is metabolic disease and spinal diseases. So we all know that there is a strong correlation with metabolic disease with disc degeneration and ligament ossification, but we don't know the mechanism. So if we can know a specific molecule or protein that is associated mediating those correlation, we can develop more precise medicine for disc degeneration. So I think, yeah, research on metabolism is really, really highly translational. And I will keep working on that, I think.
Perfect. We appreciate your contribution to NASJ. And again, I encourage everyone of our listeners to go there and read this article. It's very informative and didactic the way you present all this immense body of research on this important topic. I will appreciate your time today, and we look
Thank
forward
you very much.
To additional contributions from your team to the NASJ.